This is Radio Boston. I'm Callum Borchers. It's Friday, which on this show means Week in Review, starting with the local sports celebration at the White House yesterday.
It's my pleasure to welcome to the White House the 2018 World Series champion, the Boston Red Sox. Very special group of people.
But that special group of people did not include American League MVP Mookie Betts, pitcher David Price, outfielder Jackie Bradley Jr., shortstop Xander Bogaerts, or manager Alex Cora. In fact, most of the team's players of color skipped. Most of the players who did attend are white. One exception, slugger J.D. Martinez, teased President Trump, but in a gentle, apolitical way.
Thank you, Mr. President, for this once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to be honored today here at the White House. And I know celebrating a Red Sox victory is tough for you, given that you're a Yankee fan and all.
The president managed to swallow his New York pride and offered praise for Boston.
Boston teams have won 6 Super Bowls as well as an NBA and an NHL championship. And this has to be a great time for Boston's fans. If you think of it, what Boston has done in a short period of time is pretty amazing in a lot of ways, but in sports, certainly.
Let's turn now to our Week in Review panelists. Marie St. Fleur is a former Massachusetts state representative, now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Welcome back to the show, Marie.
Good to be here. Thank you.
Also with us is Jim Sturgis. He's the executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Welcome back, Jim.
Good to be with you.
All right, Jim, let's start with you. What was your take on the way this whole Red Sox-White House saga unfolded this week?
Well, you know, on a day in which we imposed 25% tariffs on $200 billion worth of goods with one of our major trading partners, that we are talking about the Red Sox visit to the White House tells me that we are in Boston.
That's right.
Look, this is an extremely sensitive White House. Remember that Stephen Curry decided he wouldn't go, and then he got disinvited after deciding he wouldn't go.
The whole team, I think. The whole Warriors. Yeah.
But you know what? Look, it's been about 150 years since the first amateur baseball teams went to visit the soon-to-be impeached Andrew Johnson in the White House, the first time sports teams went. And since then, we've had many people decide not to go. Manny Ramirez decided not to go twice. Tom Brady decided not to go to the Obama White House or the Trump White House. The Bruins goalie Tim Thomas famously decided not to go to the Obama White House. And this is over and over again happens. Michael Jordan decided that golf was more important to him than going to the Bush White House. That's Bush number one, by the way.
Larry Bird skipped in 84, which we talked about. And some of these players, like Tim Thomas, you mentioned, offered sort of big, long explanations for why. Marie, most of the players for the Red Sox didn't elaborate on why they didn't want to go to the White House. But pitcher Hector Velazquez did. He said he was offended by the president's rhetoric toward Mexico. And then manager Alex Cora, who's from Puerto Rico, offered this explanation to sports radio WEEI this week.
You know, just being around the island and knowing what is going on and how people are, you know, it doesn't feel right. I made sure, and I've been saying it all along, I said it last year, I said it this year, the government has helped, but we still have long ways to go. And I put it in capital letters. This is our reality. I'm the guy that has lived it. I'm the guy down there, you know, in the off season. I understand how it is, you know, and I just don't feel right going and celebrate while people are struggling back home.
Marie, I see you nodding your head there. Do you understand where he's coming from?
Well, absolutely. You know, I think in the past and with all the folks prior to Obama, I would say this was a non-political statement. You know, a president invited teams to come and celebrate. But this has become a very political statement. And so I think that it was wise of them not to get caught up in the in a picture op with this current president. As I thought about this, you are the company you keep, right? And I have no problem with respecting the office of the presidency, and you should, because that office belongs to us. It does not belong to whoever sits there. They're only there for a period of time that they're elected to be there. I think that the members of any sport team has a right to decide to attend or not attend. But in this particular instance, particularly folks of color and particularly folks of good conscience, I understand why they don't go. I mean, this is a gentleman in this office who has decided to totally disrespect people of color, particularly people coming from the areas that Alex Rodriguez and many other folks of color have come. In fact, he actually has spent a lot of time essentially dehumanizing us in so many ways. And so when you have a president where, you know, it's okay, an individual, okay? Because I don't think that's the office asking that individual to behave that way. In fact, I think that office expect the person holding it to actually be the standard bearer for who we are, the better angels in us as Americans in this country. But when you have an individual in that seat who says it's okay to rip Latino children from the arms of their parents, separate them, okay? And then we have no idea, took no care in determining the end destination of their parents. Well, you have kids that were so young who don't even remember who their parents are and will probably never be able to be reunified. I think for a person to then go and then celebrate, I think it's beyond the pale.
So it's deeply personal, right, for some of these players?
It is absolutely deeply personal.
Jim, I'm wondering, though, I mean, you know, what's the message sent, though, by these players, too? Because, you know, as Marie mentioned, there's the notion that maybe you should just respect the office of the president. We've heard that argument. I'm thinking of somebody like John Henry, who did go, the Red Sox principal owner. He also owns the Boston Globe. The president, of course, trashed the Globe last year for organizing that series of editorials nationwide that were critical of the president. I mean, he set that grudge aside and showed up. So there's that argument that you should, you know, set aside those arguments, those grudges, I should say, and just go.
Look, I agree with everything that Marie just said. I guess the point I would make is the nexus between sports and politics for me is an uninteresting one, just as celebrities with politics is not interesting to me. And you mentioned Larry Bird. Mm-hmm. I think his quote when he decided not to go is he said, "If the president wants to see me, he knows where to find me."
That's right.
And that's how
probably
I feel. If you want to go, you go. And if you don't want to go, you definitely go. If you want to make a statement, make your statement. It's absolutely cool. But it's like any individual. I wouldn't hold them up on any pedestal beyond any average individual doing the same thing.
All right. Let's move on to a national story this week that has local implications. The ride-hailing company Uber is trading on the New York Stock Exchange for the first time today. As we were coming on the air, it was trading at about $44 a share, which is lower than the company had hoped. And this comes 2 days after thousands of drivers for both Uber and Lyft in cities all around the world, including Boston, went on strike. We spoke with full-time Uber driver Kyle Tisvair this week. He's an organizer for the Boston Independent Drivers Guild.
I'm a firm believer in that these companies should be able to make money. But the way that they're doing it right now is they're subsidizing rides and they're underpaying their drivers. They use this upfront pricing because they think they're going to make more money in the long run, and they keep chipping away and chipping away at the driver.
Now, CEO Dara Khosrowshahi spoke with CNBC this morning while in the backseat of an Uber, how fitting, and he compared his company Uber to another tech behemoth, Amazon.
Just like Amazon went from being a bookseller to being an incredibly broad retailer, we want to go from car hire, essentially, to being a transportation on-demand service. We want to be Earth's everything transportation store.
Earth's everything transportation store, Marie. That's a pretty lofty goal. What are you thinking about these days?
Well, then they should really try to be an Earth transportation store that really values equity and that really values the large number of people who work for them. They call them contractors, but in essence work for them, really. And so they should do that. I mean, in this gig economy where they can actually raise in private equity about $62.5 billion, they then now are probably, valued at probably over $80 billion, yet they take advantage of many people who use the gig economy as an opportunity to put food on their table and to take care of their children. The reality is they use them as contractors. And so they have no payroll, no payroll taxes are paid by them. They really do not support them with insurance. They do not support them with workers' comp. And so these folks are out on their own when they're ill. So I think that they have some responsibility if they're going to establish a new economy, that they create a different economy that just simply doesn't take advantage, but actually builds equitable access to a living wage.
Can I ask you, though, I'm curious about the valuation that you just mentioned, because that number stands out. And you're right about right. With the IPO, they ended up being valued at $82 billion when they went public, but that was lower, Jim, than they were hoping for. Reuters had originally reported that investment bankers told Uber that they could be valued at $120 billion if they went public, and then they originally priced hoping for a range between 90 and 100. down to 82. They're trading today below that. And what's going on with this company? Is it what Marie's talking about? Maybe investors aren't so happy about the business model that puts the squeeze to drivers.
I don't think anybody really knows exactly what the business model is, and I think that's one of the problems. I think there are three problems here. One is, look, there was incredibly – and this is not to diminish the value of the folks who are out in the street striking, but if you look at the number of people striking, it was 25 in London, 25 in L.A., a couple hundred in San Francisco, which is their home base, 50 in New York City. Even though it's small, though – Uber pushed back big time. Why is that? Because Uber knows that it's a very slippery slope for them. The things that can cap their growth in the short term is unionization and government regulation. They've seen this movie play out in parts of Europe where, for example, in Rome, they're not allowed to really operate with any expanse to them. The second thing is I think Uber is a place that they have to behave in a monumentally crafty way, a bit like Amazon. They're not like a PayPal. They're not like a new service that goes into one area and basically own the space. They're competing with existing providers of that service. That means they have to roll up a whole bunch of services, push people out of the marketplace, and they can basically try and set their price. The question
is meant, by the way, that they've had to spend handsomely to do so, right, to stay ahead of Lyft, and they're not yet profitable.
Absolutely. I think the point here is, though, what happens if they raise their prices to make money? They start losing market share. And the other thing is, and here's the ugly truth, I think that, or this is what they're aiming for. Their money will be made when there are driverless cars. That's the business model. And they're trying to work out for the next 5 to 10 years till they get there. And that is a pretty ugly truth that all of us have to try and deal with. What do we do about that? The equity issue that Marie raised is a real issue. So there's a lot going on there. I think the investors stay in this, the ones that have stayed in it, because they see the long term. They're not doing it for the next 5 to 10 years of profits.
Yeah, we heard the same thing this week from Bloomberg's Anne Mastu, who we had on the show. She said that they're also aiming for the driverless cars. And so, Marie, as Jim says, there's kind of a broader automation trend going on here. We've seen this come up in the Stop and Shop strike, in the Marriott strike. Automation is a big deal in a lot of these working professions right now.
Absolutely. And so, therefore, regulators do have to take a quick look at this and understand what the implication is going to be for the workforce that's being generated out of there. Because you have the reason why you probably have a significant people that don't show up for these types of strikes is because, you know what, this is the only way that they're able to make a living. Mm-hmm. And so there's a fear factor here. So there's a deterrence in going out there and organizing against Uber. It's a double-edged sword because on the other hand, a government hasn't done what it's supposed to do with really establishing a transportation system that is equitable, that allows a lot of places. So in some of the communities here in Massachusetts who actually don't have access to fair transportation. And so for some families, that is actually a good way for them to be able to get transportation back and forth. And so I think if we begin to take a holistic look at our transportation models and to figure out how this fits in, it's not a bad idea, because I think that it's important that we say that it's not a bad idea. But I do think there's a level of equity and fairness that is not being built into the system. And as soon as they get those driverless cars, those folks that they're now propping up are going to be left behind. And so government has to step in and figure out what is the best way for the system to move forward.
So we've got a lot to watch there. The stock price, driverless cars, a lot of trends that we'll be watching for with Uber and Lyft in the years to come.
Right.
In the moments that we have left, I do want to ask you both about some news out of the Catholic Church this week. Pope Francis has issued new rules, requiring priests and nuns to report incidents of sexual abuse or cover-ups to church authorities. However, the sweeping regulations do not require reporting to law enforcement. And for folks like Ann Barrett Doyle, who's the co-director of the Boston-based group Bishop Accountability, that's a major shortcoming.
This new law does not mandate reporting to civil authorities. What it does is deepen and systematize the internal process for handling allegations. The problem is that the church is inherently secretive, and this does nothing to change the secrecy of the Catholic Church.
So what do you think, Jim? Is this a positive step forward? Does it still not go far enough?
So on the one hand, it's about time they do something that's much bigger and much more consistent than they had done before. But this is just not far enough. I completely agree with what she just said in the sense that I think the solution here, and this is also true of higher education, where higher education has gotten to the space of trying to adjudicate potential crimes. on their campuses. I think this is a simple thing where if there's a crime or an allegation of a crime, you take it to the civil authorities. It's a much cleaner way to do things because whether you are the Catholic Church with hundreds of years, thousands of years of history of keeping things from civil authorities or your institution of higher education, you are conflicted. One, you're not equipped to adjudicate, but second, you're conflicted because you're trying to protect your reputation. Problem is people get hurt in the meantime.
Marie, though, one of the things that we heard out of the big summit that the Catholic Church held earlier this year on clergy sexual abuse was that one of the reasons perhaps to not require mandating to law enforcement is that there are parts of the world where Catholics and Christians are a persecuted minority. We saw some real violence erupt on Easter in Sri Lanka, for example, right? And so the worry is that if they go to law enforcement, they might be putting themselves in danger. Do you buy that explanation?
I think there's a balancing act that has to be. And so when you take a look at all of the United States, all of America, all of the Americas, and see the amount of the number of sexual abuse cases that have come out just out of that, we know that the church has not been good at policing itself. And so all we have is written into canon law the idea that the church will police itself. And we're still leaving children and a lot of others who are who do not have a way to fend for themselves at risk. So I agree that there's those instances, but I also think that there may be ways to mitigate that. And so the question shouldn't be, let's not do anything because there might be these instances in the world. I mean, there are tons of instances in the world where the law is applicable, the civil law is applicable, and it really challenges the opportunity for a select minority. And so the question is, what do we do in working with those civil governments in order to make certain that that minority is protected? It's not to say, well, let's just keep policing ourselves. It has not worked.
I'll mention that Cardinal Sean O'Malley has voiced his support for this new edict out of Pope Francis. He says in part, quote, this document directly addresses needed improvements to the church's response. And O'Malley goes on to say that it has become far more clear that the people of the church and our wider society rightfully demand substantive action for the disclosure, transparency, and accountability with regard to any occurrence of sexual abuse or intimidation or cover-up in the life of the church. Marie St. Fleur is a former Massachusetts state representative and now a principal at St. Fleur Communications. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Jim Sturgis is the executive director of the Pioneer Institute. Our thanks to you as well.
Thank you. I'm going to vote for Marie St. Fleur once again, even if she's not running.
You can write her in.
I'm not running.
You can write her in.
Oh, I'm not running. Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Callum Borchers. This is Radio Boston.